Hello everybody, my name's Peter Lipman. I'm your facilitator today. I'm the chair of Transition Network, which is the charity which seeks to underpin the work of transition initiatives all around the world. I was thinking about my links to the cooperative movement. I've had a bank account with the co-op for 32 years. I'm not sure if that counts for much. I used to work in a whole food wholesaler, initially called Nova, then called Essential, which was a workers' cooperative. So, and I certainly have a strong belief in cooperative principles. So it's a really great pleasure to be here at what, for us in the transition movement, is a new step, this idea of having a joint conference with the cooperative. And we're really interested to see what comes out of it. And I'm going to start with the usual housekeeping, which is fire exits and toilets. Toilets, this floor, ground floor, and the disabled toilet, I gather, is at the back of the building. Fire exits on this floor, that is the fire exit. And you go down the steps. There's a push-open door out at the back, and then you turn right and go through to the car park to assemble. If the fire alarm goes off and you're downstairs, then the fire exit is down in that corner underneath on the next floor down, through two doors and again out to the car park. And unless the organisers tell me different, I think that's all of the housekeeping for now. We won't do all the housekeeping around workshops until just before we break for lunch. But there will be, there are a lot of workshops and they're in different places and there will be marshals and there will be a system to make sure that you all get to your workshops and don't get lost, we hope. So now it's a really great pleasure for me because for quite a few years I've been reading about Kirk Lees's innovative scheme for energy conservation. And so it's really appropriate and a great pleasure for me to introduce, and I want to get this right, the worshipful mayor of Kirk Lees, Councillor Julie Stewart Turner.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you. It really is a great pleasure for me to be here today to open this first Transition North conference. And I just wanted to congratulate everybody that's been involved in bringing this conference together today and providing us this opportunity to explore some very complicated issues. We all know that taking the first steps in any new initiative is a very brave thing to do. And that there are a lot of people in here that have been very brave to take some first steps already and become very positive examples of community leadership. We all know that change can be frightening for many, but it is very, very clear that change is needed and our current way of living is not sustainable. But we know that that change will be less frightening, more effective, and much more sustainable if it comes from within our communities. We do know individuals that have made massive differences in the world, but nothing is more powerful than people coming together and being united in a common goal. We are very lucky today to have some amazing speakers that are going to be sharing their experiences with us. And I regret that I won't be able to stay for the workshops this afternoon. I would have loved to have been part of those workshops. There's some terrific topics to debate. But I'm going to really indulge myself now before I hand over and formally open the event. I need to tell you about my own local food awards. And many of you might already know that I've adopted as my corporate theme for this year, local farming and local food production. We've got a lot of different activities planned throughout the years. We've had quite a few different activities already. And I've been overwhelmed, really, with the enthusiasm and passion and the amount of support that there has been for this campaign. So the Local Food Awards is just one of many different things we're doing, but it's going to become at the end of the year, which I think is going to be a very exciting few months. There are going to be four categories, which is business, education, communities, and individual local food heroes. We've already introduced, as part of the campaign, a local food section on the Kirklees Council website. And in the next few days, you'll be able to get information packs off the website. And it would be really nice if we could get many of you in here to take part in the campaign or spread the word about it. We found the awards is a vehicle to motivate people to think about what they're doing and to encourage them to build on their successes already. The closing date for the nominations is the 12th of February, so the more nominations, the better. So after that self-indulgent moment, I'm sure you're going to have a lovely conference, and I wish you all a great day, and congratulations again to everybody who's been involved so far. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Ben. If people have got their phones on, could they switch them off or maybe to silent? We've got three speakers. Each is going to speak for about 20 minutes, and I've asked each of them to finish their talk with a question to you, because I get rather bored at conferences where the audience asks the speakers questions and the speakers hand out their wisdom. And I thought maybe, given the assembled intelligence here in the floor, we should ask the speakers to ask the audience questions. Don't worry too much about remembering them, because Ed at the back is going to put them onto a PowerPoint slide. So when we come to what we do immediately after the third speaker, the questions will be up there to use. Okay? So first, I'm going to let Rob Hopkins introduce himself and go straight into his talk.
Good morning. It's fantastic to be here and for this to be here at this event. And this idea of regional gatherings is something that's starting to happen increasingly, and it's really exciting to see. So congratulations to all the organisers for this, and thanks for the invitation. I've been asked to give a kind of an overview of transition and to kind of set the scene for where the transition idea comes from for people here who may not be so familiar with it, and to give a sense of where it's all going. I think it's always useful to start thinking about anything in our life by taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture and looking at the wider context in which the decisions that we make and the actions that we're doing sit. And when you take a look back over a wider perspective in terms of our civilization, and particularly in relation to its energy sources, it looks quite different for those of us who've grown up always with energy at our fingertips. If you look back over a sort of 4,000-year span, then really the period of time that we live through now can be thought of as being the petroleum interval, as being this short period in time where we've discovered this astonishing energy source under our feet, and then set about building a society and a culture, a civilization, a way of doing everything based on the assumption that we're always going to have that. But actually, increasingly, it's looking like we are close to the top of the mountain, metaphorically speaking, in terms of energy, and that really the work of ours and future generations is to design a productive and abundant, successful way to navigate down the far side. Peak oil is the two things that really underpin transition is this idea of peak oil and climate change as well. Peak oil is the observation that doesn't mean that tomorrow we're going to run out of oil. It means that we can reach a point where we pass the point where we never will produce that much again. 1965 was the year we discovered the most oil. We now consume 4 or 5 barrels of oil for every one that we consume. That gap continues to widen. And within that, of course, there's also the thing that when you start, you use the largest oil fields first, and then they get smaller and smaller. So by the time you get to the top, you don't have any enormous super giant oil fields left to find. So it's not the end of oil, it's the end of cheap and easy oil. And this is where we find ourselves at this point in time. So the small fields that we're discovering now really don't do much to reverse that pattern. There's also this idea of energy return on investment, which is crucial when you meet people who say, but there's loads of oil in the Alberta tar sands, or there's the shale oil over here, or whatever. That you have to put energy in to get energy back out again. Richard Heinberg always says, if you're a fox and you eat rabbits and you spend more energy chasing rabbits around the place than you get from actually eating them, you're not going to be a fox for very long. So when we started producing oil in Saudi Arabia in the 30s, you put one unit of energy in, you got about 100 out. Completely unprecedented energy return for human beings, never happened before. Now with oil, that's down to 15, 10 to 1. The Alberta tar sands are down to 2 or 3. So although we have this complete sort of the dark blue is the total energy resource that we have, the energy that we extract from that falls off much, much sharper again. In Canada, in the US, for example, now, although total coal production in terms of mass continues to rise, the energy that's taken from it has plateaued and started to fall. So when we look at the UK situation, where we find ourselves at the end of lots of very long pipelines, our history is quite illuminating. So up until the 80s, we were an energy importer, but we were an energy importer at a time when oil prices, energy prices internationally were relatively stable, apart from the 70s, obviously mid-70s. Then we discovered North Sea oil and gas, and we had a party. But we sold a lot of that oil and gas at a time when oil and gas prices were very, very low. Now the UK, due to the very, very sharp depletion in the North Sea, is a net energy importer again, but at a time when those energy prices are increasingly volatile. And that leaves us in a very, very vulnerable position. The other issue, as I said, that really underpins the transition approach is climate change. And I won't talk too much about the general idea of climate change, assume people are up to speed with that. But I think what's emerging in the more recent cutting-edge science about it is that actually the situation is more urgent than the IPCC had been saying. And we're starting to see things happen just with the rise in temperature that we've had already that weren't supposed to happen for quite some time yet. That things are moving much faster, and the idea that we can go up to 450 parts per million before we need to change direction, a lot of people are now saying actually 350 was the tipping point, and what we need to be doing is to work out how to go back to that. So really the rapid decarbonisation of every aspect of what we do is astonishingly urgent. So in transition, what we do is we put those two issues together and we overlap them. And you say you can't look at one of them in isolation from another. Because if you look at just peak oil on its own, it's a liquid fuels problem. Where are we going to get enough liquid fuel in the UK to run 30 million cars and a million lorries? Where's all that going to come from? If you just look at climate change on its own, then you can often end up looking just at sort of technofix solutions, offsets, this kind of thing. But when you overlap them, you have three key priorities, one of which is planning, that this isn't going to come about by accident. We're not just going to find ourselves serendipitously wandering into a low-energy world that somehow has just come about by chance. This requires a lot of intentional, creative planning and design, a lot of rethinking of basic assumptions. Power down, the idea of conserving on a big scale, and also of changing the scale on which we operate. So moving more towards a relocalization of local economies, and also power up in terms of putting in place renewables and the energy systems that we're going to need in order to get through this period. I like to think about that picture that I started with about looking at the oil age and its perspective. I wonder what the stories of people further down the slope will tell about us, about the generation that parted so hard and abused their inheritance. And of course we won't know because that's off in the future, but the way I'd like to think about it is by looking at the stories that people used to tell before they had the kind of energy at their disposal that we have now, that we just totally take for granted and don't even think about. We had stories like the Seven League Boots, where you had a whole generation for whom travel involved animal muscle power, their own muscle power, and that was about it. The idea that you could travel at great speed was completely unimaginable. The idea that you would find a giant asleep under a tree and steal his boots, and once you had them on, you could travel 21 miles with every stride was the stuff of a huge fantasy. For people who knew where their food came from, they either grew it themselves or they were very linked into the local food economy, the idea that you would have a pot where you just had to say a magic word to it and it would just feed your family without you having to do any work, as long as you remembered the word to stop it making porridge, which was a bit of a social gaffe, I think. And then there was a story of the elves and the shoemaker about people who made things to sell. Magically, the things were just made for them overnight. They didn't have to do anything. These things just appeared and they sold them and became enormously rich. Now, of course, we live in a world where the Seven League boots are Ryanair, the magic porridge pot is Tesco's, and the elves are China, in effect. But actually, we don't have an appreciation of that. That's, you know, there's such a huge amount of embodied energy underpinning our lifestyles, and it's really important, I think, to get a handle on that. I want to talk about four different stories. So in The Transition Timeline, a book that Sean Chamberlain wrote for the Transition Network, he talks about four stories about where we go from now. So the first one is denial, which is that we just, not a problem, don't want to know, we're just going to keep on going and see what happens. Hitting the wall, which is where we decide that peak oil and climate change is something we need to do something about, but we don't change any of the underlying assumptions or values that underpin that. There's the impossible dream, where technology just comes to the rescue and solves everything for us. And there's the transition vision. And I'm going to come back to these at the end in relation to the topic of today. But transition as a response is something which has emerged over the last 3 or 4 years. It has various kind of qualities to it, I think. It's viral. It's something that spreads very quickly. There was a sneeze in Kinsale. There was a sneeze in Totnes. And now there's people sneezing all over the world as a result of it. And it seems to have the capacity to spread very quickly in that way. It's open source. People pick it up, they play around with it, and then they pass it on. It's iterative, it learns from everyone's experience of what's working and what's not working in different parts of the world. It's positive and solutions focused, and it looks different everywhere. Every different transition initiative sets up in is very particular to its place and to its culture, and it emerges from that. This is when we had Ed Miliband at the Transition Network conference this year, who was invited to attend as a keynote listener, which he did with great enjoyment, actually. So at the moment there's 249 transition initiatives around the world of the formal ones. But they're also what we call the mullers, the ones who are mulling whether they're going to become transition projects or not, who are at an earlier stage, and there's thousands of them. We've really lost track of that. It's something that is just off and out there. So there are now national hubs as well in the US, in Scotland, in Italy, in Sweden, who are holding the transition initiatives and the work that's taking place in those countries. Based always on the idea that transition is a process driven by communities who act as a catalyst. It's not something that arrives as a box where you just take out all the solutions and then they all just fit together and it's all done for you. It's a catalyst. It's a process that you start and the solutions emerge from the community itself and from the people. And one of the key ideas behind it all is resilience, this idea of resilience, which I think is now a much more useful concept than sustainability, in that resilience is about the ability of settlements and economies and communities to withstand shock from the outside so that when they encounter that shock, they don't unravel and just fall to pieces. And in the year 2000, when the lorry drivers went on strike, it became very clear that we don't have a great deal of resilience left in this country, that the local food systems that we would have been able to step off onto when the lorries stopped running for a few days just weren't there anymore. And this is a photograph of Totnes, where I live in the 1930s. And when this picture was taken, the most of the bottom half of that picture was food production within the town itself, which is all car parks now in the 21st century. And this idea of resilience, I think, is really important and is growing in interest very, very quickly. So just a few tastes of some of the things that are happening around the country with this. So this idea of producing local food directories is not something novel to transition, but it's often where transition initiatives around food get started in terms of mapping their local food landscapes and really starting to work out what's around them in terms of local food so people can connect to it. The idea of linking up, there's obviously with allotments, but this is a project that we have in Totnes, which is based on the idea that there's a long waiting list for allotments, and not everyone's going to get one, but at the same time, if you look at this town from above, there's loads of land that's just not being used. So we run a dating agency, in effect, to put people who would like to garden together with people who have a garden, something which is now being replicated in quite a few other places, very easy to manage. The whole idea of community-supported agriculture, I'm sure there's will be discussed further in the workshops. This is a community-supported pig thing, a pig club that I went to recently. But I think that whole thing of communities coming together and setting these things up themselves is really exciting to see. And the whole thing of reskilling is a vital aspect of this. The amount of skills that we've lost and just the daily in our daily lives. I wonder how many people here garden who didn't know how to do so 5 years ago? Okay, and how many people feel their quality of life has been depleted as a result? Exactly. See, I think sometimes we can get so stuck in this thing of thinking that actually, you know, responding to peak oil and climate change is about kind of going backwards and is sort of some kind of great enormous chore. But actually, I think if we do it properly, we get so much from it and enrichment in terms of skills and rediscovering what hands are for and reconnecting with the people around us. The whole area of local currencies is something which transition groups have been playing around with. This is in Lewis. The Lewis pound, they have a 1, a 5, a 10, and a 21-pound note. I love the 21-pound note. Just there's something, well, why not, really? If you're making your own money, why not? You do what you like, really. But I think they're far more beautiful banknotes than sterling, and they're taken in over 100 shops in the area. And I was in Brixton recently for the launch of the Brixton pound, which was quite the most extraordinary thing. And they recently had the big chain shops in Brixton, Marks and Spencer's and Boots and Starbucks have been getting in touch with the Brixton pound saying, can we take the Brixton pound? And which is quite interesting sort of discussions for them. And they said, of course, actually the thing is really anyone can take the Brixton pound. They don't need our permission to take, you know, taxi, anyone can take them. But actually at the moment we're in this really nice position where they don't know that. So we can say, well, we might let you if you do this, 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 and this, and this. But this idea of a currency that just cycles around locally is something that quite a few places are starting to play with. Each of them learns from the previous ones. It's a really fascinating kind of iterative process. And also you can pay your council tax in them in Brixton now, which is a first, the first time that's happened. Things like solar buyers clubs, getting people together, is not something that's new. But one of the things that I think is really interesting, and where we start to get into the overlap between transition and co-ops, which is something that the following speakers are going to look at in more depth, is around how we get communities to invest in themselves. And in the 1800s was where the cooperative movement came from, what it did so brilliantly, in terms of building that degree of economic resilience. So we're seeing that starting to emerge in some of the local energy companies that are starting to come at this stage. And where transition projects build up to is doing what we call an energy descent plan. And Totnes have been working on this for a little while now, and that will be out sometime in the next month and a half. It's really a plan B for the settlement, because still, when our councils plan for the future of where we live, they do so based on assumptions that there'll be more cheap energy, more housing, more cars, more economic growth in 10 or 15 years than there is now, all of which are highly, highly questionable. So this is looking at, well, what might it look like if we engage with this creatively? What could we actually produce out of this that is better than where we start from now in 2009? Just a tiny little bit on food, because I know food is one of the themes running through it. One of the things we've done as part of that is to try and answer this question, can Totnes and District feed itself? And trying to map food footprints of different settlements, which is quite a sobering process, because you can go somewhere like Totnes as a rural market town and think, there's loads of land. But when you look at it in the context of the towns and settlements around it, there's lots of pressure on the land from different places. And trying to look at the degree to which, what degree of food relocalization is possible, is desirable, as a way of being one of the key things that regenerates the economy of communities like this. And so we've started to kind of map that based on the land that's available and trying to overlap those on each other. It's been very, very interesting. And why we're the people doing that work is a mystery to me. I always thought that was what DEFRA were for, but then that's me being desperately naive, I'm sure. One of the things that's emerging in transition as well is this food pilot, which is about drawing out all the different projects that are happening around the country that relate to food so that we don't have huge amounts of wheel reinvention going on. This is now up online as a beta. If you have food projects where you are, transitionfood.org.uk, please go in and post your projects if you have any questions about that. It's something that we're just launching now. Ed, if you want to stand up, Mrs. Ed at the back, who's doing that, and do ask Ed. He's holding that rather exciting development. So just to finish off, I thought I would just muse on what the relationship between transition initiatives and the co-op and co-ops might look like in four of those different stories that I touched on earlier on. I think in this one, in the denial, the business as usual scenario, which is where we don't want to know about peak oil, we don't want to know about climate change, our goal is getting economic growth back on track at all costs, and we just go for it. It may sound melodramatic, but I think the results of that would be really unprecedented and deeply unpleasant. When you have the perfect storm of all of these things coming together, I like to think of it in terms of a Christmas carol. You know, it's the ghost of Christmas future that we really hope doesn't come to pass. But actually, there is a real danger of some significant degree of unravelling, an unpleasantness of the lights going off, Britain being bankrupt. All of those things are a definite possibility if we continue to stick our head in the sand, as is illustrated here. Hitting the wall is the idea that actually what we respond to is climate change, and we ignore peak oil altogether, and that we assume that we can that really all we need to do is change, is to make that response, but not change the stories that underpin it. So we're still in pursuit of continual economic growth, of a highly globalized economy, but we just think that we can stick some solar panels on the roof and everything will be all right. So you might see an example then that all the cooperative stores are zero carbon, they have photovoltaics on the roof, they don't use plastic bags, they have carbon labeling on everything. But still, in a world of highly volatile energy prices, it's still very, very vulnerable. You could see a situation where the transition initiatives on the ground are trying to push cooperative stores to be much more linked with local community, and that doesn't come to pass. And increasingly, as time goes on, that failure to build resilience over time becomes much, much more acutely felt. The impossible dream, where we might have some amazing new fuel that's discovered, we can make hydrogen, we run everything on hydrogen, food for the cooperative shops is grown in huge vertical farms in the middle of the city, we have genetically modified crops that are somehow incredibly designed to lock up carbon, we have compressed air cars, we're all flying around like Star Wars, we invent some amazing machine that sucks carbon out of the atmosphere, and climate change is all just completely sorted through wonderful Boffin's brilliance. There's no transition initiatives anymore because they're not really needed. We get our lunch in a little pill, but that's not going to happen. The transition vision, on the other hand, is really about acknowledging that the move towards relocalization is an inevitability and is also an enormous opportunity. That inherent within responding to peak oil and climate change is the potential for an economic, social, and cultural renaissance, the likes of which we've never seen before. And the story of this transition vision could be that in 2009, the co-op and maybe the National Trust and some other big organizations took this really, really seriously and decided that they saw the future of themselves as enterprises, as organizations, in pursuing that agenda. So it could be that by 2020, for the cooperative stores, they're almost more like markets with a number of local community enterprises that operate from them as well. Some of the food is sourced from what we might call patchwork farms, from people throughout the town growing on a small scale within their gardens or small amounts of land in order to supply the shops. Food is much more seasonal. Maybe the car parks have become intensive market gardens. The cooperative farms are producing more than just food. They also produce building materials, maybe fabrics, fuel, timber, this kind of thing. The vegetables that are sold through the shops are very locally produced. Cereals and grains and so on come from further afield. There's less meat, I would imagine, in that context. That the way that the food is grown will inevitably be organic, given the UK's natural gas situation, which is where currently our fertilisers come from. And the question of whether there'll be one cooperative model or lots, whether there'll be one transition model or lots, will all be very interesting. But I think that inherent within that, and actually if we apply the kind of creative thinking that we're seeing emerging in communities all across the UK, all across the North here, as people come together to act as catalysts and think these questions through, if we can apply that kind of brilliance in time and with the passion that those of you who are here today obviously bring to this, I think what we can create from this is really extraordinary and something that future generations will have every right to sing songs and tell stories about. Thank you very much. So my question to you, I feel like Obama there. My question to you. I like to think that this transition offers, as I said before, offers the potential for an economic, social, and cultural renaissance, the likes of which we have never seen. What might the relationship between... Are you writing this down, Ed? It's a long question. What might the relationship between co-ops and transition initiatives look like in that context? Shall I say that again? I like to think that this transition offers the potential for an economic, social, and cultural renaissance, the likes of which we have never seen. What might the relationship between the co-op and transition initiatives look like in that context? Okay, thank you.
Hello, I'm Christine Taken, and I run the co-op's farming business. And I'm hoping that you'll get some slides coming up, because I've got lots of pictures that I wanted to show you. I'm actually bringing you back to today. I think a lot of what we've been hearing about is what we need to aspire for the future. I can tell you what we're doing today. I can tell you what we're planning for the short term. But I do feel I'm walking towards where you're taking me, but I haven't gone very far yet. So I just sort of want to put back some, get in some context. Now, the Co-op Farms is, you may have read some of the packaging of our products. It says we're Britain's biggest farmer. In fact, we farm less than 1% of all of the land in the UK. Farming is a massively fragmented industry. But also, we are absolutely minute in the cooperative group. And as a sort of, I think some people sort of think that it's a matter of if we grow the food on our farms, of course it'll be in the food stores. Everything I do is with competitive tender. It's a commercial relationship between us two. And there was a time, not anymore, I have to say, 5 years ago, when I had to sometimes remind publications about the co-op that you haven't mentioned the farming business, whereas now we're a little bit more central to their thinking. So we've been in farming, as you can see from that, over 100 years. We farm about 50,000 acres. They're largely down the east side of the country. Some of the dots on the west, I mean, one of us is the Manchester head office. We don't grow very much there yet. We are very much more focused on growing for our stores, which has been a huge change of initiative. In the year 2002, when we came out of dairying, we were selling nothing from our farms to our own group. There's now a huge change in that, and the figure so far year to date, by the way, is 66% of turnover, just to give you an idea of where we've come from. And now more and more that not only the co-op farms being seen as key to helping the group deliver its energy strategy, it's starting to become part of how we're going to deliver our food strategy, which is very exciting. And I'm jumping straight away, when I do many presentations, this is my final slide, but you asked me to discuss so many things, I've just brought it back to my second one so I can get on. But you can see the range of products we've got there, all of that's grown from our farms, whether it be the beer from our barley, or the cider, or the apple juice, you've got your peas, your strawberries, broccoli, onions, flour, honey, and potatoes, which is by far the biggest thing we do. So you can see it's a reasonable range of products, and this year we introduced sweet corn, and this year we're also 100% of the co-op's beetroot. So we are making quite a lot of progress, which is where all that turnover is coming from. But I tried to summarise what the issues that we're facing on this one chart. Don't get put off by it all. This is really about UK self-sufficiency of food. And you can see that this on this chart here, this figure is what we're producing in the UK, and that's what we export. And if you add those two figures together, it says that we're about, you know, we're about 60% self-sufficient. But of the food that we eat, so I mean, obviously we don't grow bananas here, not yet anyway, but of the food that we could grow in the UK, we could be 73%. So that's the difference between the 60 and the 60% is all food, and 73% is of the food that we could grow in the UK anyway. But it is absolutely shocking that we're only 11% self-sufficient in fruit. The apple industry's been decimated in the UK. We are planting at the rate of knots, and just we are a reasonable sized apple grower. We've got 400,000 apple trees, all of them individually hand-pruned, just to give you an idea. And we're 58, as a nation, we're 58% self-sufficient in vegetables. The shocking thing, the really shocking thing for me, and I don't know whether I'm going to sound xenophobic, is the fact that 25% of our fruit and vegetables are actually coming from Netherlands and France. So it's not bananas and things that you can't grow locally. And I think another shocking thing is the fact that the biggest players in UK, in every meat sector and in dairying, are all Dutch and Danish farmer cooperatives. They're the biggest players in the UK industry. And our biggest export, I only wrote down the exports that were over 500 million, so you can see what we import and what we export. Our main export, the only export we've got over 500 million, is whiskey. So even if we shut our borders, we'd all have to live off whiskey in order to survive. And one of the big issues that we've had recently on price inflation, which will continue, is actually the euro against the pound. And that's why we've been able to get slightly better prices as farmers for our strawberries this year, because it costs the retailers 20% more to go and buy them from Spain. So the euro is causing a huge, huge fragility to pricing in the UK. But I suppose the other point I should make out about this wonderful slide that's got everything on it is the fact that that green bar has been getting smaller. So we're becoming less and less self-sufficient. So then jumping on to what we're doing in the co-op, our current three-year plan is to actually produce 25% of anything that can be grown in the UK off of our farms. And we've got priority categories because marketing wants something that we do nationally that they can put on television advertising. So therefore, we're trying to do apples, strawberries and potatoes in very big size, you know, in very big volume, such that we can potentially get into all co-op stores. Then the other produce that we're talking about, things like well, beetroot's national, but it's not yet such an exciting product that you'd put it on national advertising. But like broccoli, for example, we grow it in Wisbeach, and that goes all over East Anglia, but it obviously doesn't come up here. And then we're trying to grow the sort of cereal crops that we grow a lot, and a lot of those are obviously in rotation around the vegetables. You can only grow potatoes once every 7 years, so you've got to put something in between. We're trying to find homes for those in our products, which is where we've got flour. We've actually got our first bread rolls made from our flour, and the barley and the beer, and obviously oats is... I haven't quite got there yet, but that'll be going into porridge and things like that. In fact, one of the really difficult things that I have is trying to segregate our product when it's going through a processor without adding cost. And that was one of the issues with the oats, because they're just all these flow processes, and trying to keep ours separate so we could guarantee that the oats that came out the other end were the ones that we'd grown was adding too much cost. But if we grow a lot more, then it isn't a problem, because then everybody's oats are our oats, so it doesn't matter. They know they're all ours. But that's our current three-year plan. But now that food security's gone up the agenda, food retail have turned around to us and said, what more could you do to actually help us with food security within our co-op food stores? And they're starting to talk to us about, well, could you help us out in categories where we're facing shortages, such as pigs, such as strawberries. Sometimes it's shortages in negotiating power, and sometimes it's just that there isn't enough in the UK. Also, we're trying to keep the margin within our business. So where we're packing products, at the moment we pack potatoes, we've just this year bought a pack house where we're packing our own strawberries and our broccoli, which of course means an awful lot less handling, because we're not having to give them to third parties. And in fact, in many cases, we're selling our product to a third party that then packages it and then sells it back to the co-op, and of course is taking a margin in the middle. So we're saying, if we're growing enough to be an efficient packer, we want to be a packer as well, so we've got that interest in the whole supply chain. And to focus on anything that can be grown competitively in the UK. So if it can be grown in the UK, we should be trying to grow it. So it is a huge change in strategy, and will actually take us to about 3/4 of all the UK's fruit and vegetables. It's got a big price tag on it, which is why I can't say this is what we're definitely doing. We're still still trying to work out the speed with which we can afford to do it. We've got to pay for Summerfield first. And the other thing that we're talking about is whether we have the Grown By Us brand, which is everything from our farms, whether it can go beyond the UK, you know, when there's something where we have to grow outside, you know, outside the UK season, do we do that or do we actually keep it as a UK brand so that people know when it's grown by us that it's the UK? We haven't, because obviously there are times when it's more greenhouse gas efficient, whatever you want to call it, to grow overseas than to grow in the UK, and that's a conundrum we haven't yet sorted out. And the reason that there's a big price tag on it is that bottom one, which is about purchasing the land to grow our fruit and vegetables on. And there is, you know, money has been put aside, but not as much as I want yet. But we'll keep going on that one. So one of the other things I was asked to talk about was what we're doing in terms of energy generation and how we farm. So I've just put a little bit of an overview and focusing on one particular farm, which is our Coldham estate near Wisbeach, which is probably the farm, apart from maybe Tillington, our apple farm, but where I'm proudest of everything that we've done in integrating with the co-op. It's absolutely fantastic land. It's a very big farm. It's all on one area. You can see the reservoirs there on the blue dots. And as you can see, we're growing a lot of vegetables for, straight for the food stores. There are now 8 2-megawatt wind turbines there, and we got planning permission for 7 more. And the group buys green energy. So although it's, you know, all in an amorphous mass in the wires somewhere, but we are generating it and getting it back in other ways. We've also got planning permission for another 15 wind turbines on another one of our farms, which will mean with those two farms together, we will already be at 10% of generating the group's own electricity, which is actually very exciting and a lovely way of getting the farming business actually working well with the whole group. But just for some examples of what we're doing on the farm in terms of irrigation in efficiency, what this little map here just behind your head is showing, thank you, is how we've got probes in the ground and we're actually measuring how wet the soil is, and then we're putting some water on and then measuring it and putting some water on where we're just trying to get it just into the blue. You don't want to give the crop any more water than it actually needs. I mean, this is winter stored water, so it's not a wasteful way of doing it, but we're just making sure that we manage the amount of water in the crop. This is actually for potatoes where we're doing that. And just little things like starting it up in the field means that you've got much tighter control than if you're actually turning it back on at the mains. The other thing we're doing is we're actually doing this on every farm. This particular farm is different. On all of the other farms, we've got what's called nitrogen sensors on the front of the tractors that senses the greenness in a crop as it goes over. And if it's very green, it doesn't need any fertilizer. And so it's sort of measuring the greenness to control the fertilizer that we're using. So this particular one on this farm, we're doing it by satellite. And you can see the brown areas are the areas where we are nitrogen deficient. So we are using nitrogen on our farms, but what we're trying to do is to be much more intelligent about where we use it. And in all honesty, there's one, I mean, I can say I'm doing it because of greenhouse gas emissions. The real truth is it's extraordinarily expensive and I can't afford to waste it. So you know, actually high cost of these things is a key way of actually driving the right behavior. We're using compost and the GPS mapping is when we actually take cores all over the farm and make sure that we don't put any more, that's phosphorus and potassium in on the land than we need to. And the other thing that we're doing in a very big way in our farming business is about education. The biggest project we have by a long way is the From Farm to Fork, when you've all got this little leaflet. It's not exactly aimed at you, though if you might read something and learn about it if you don't know much about farming. But 8 to 10-year-olds is the target age group, so do get those into the right hands if you can. It talks about the seasons and how to cook food. We've had this year over 20,000 children on our farms spending half a day outside understanding where crops grow, digging up potatoes, showing them how to lay a hedge, why we're doing all of these things. Each farm is different. They do whatever they're growing on that farm. And then half a day inside cooking. And the first thing we do on every single visit is take some wheat, put it in a coffee grinder and show them this is what flour is. Wow. And the shocking thing is how surprised the teachers are. But... We also have on our Coldham farm, because we've got all this energy, we've actually got an energy education project rather than a cooking education project. We can't do both in one day. And this is actually done with all the Fenland schools, and it's terribly exciting because this is sort of a local council-driven initiative. Everybody who puts up a wind farm has to put some money towards education. All that funding has come to our education project, which is entirely run free of charge to the children. It just happens to be on our farm. And the children are coming and spending a day there, looking at all sorts of different ways of using energy, and they go and look at the wind farm, and it's very exciting. They can see them. I mean, if you go to that area of the Fens, they're everywhere, so it's great for them to come. We don't allow them to go up, but even just sort of standing right underneath them is fascinating. And as you can see, we've had a fair number of children doing that as well. So I think taking the energy right down to education is a key thing, and I think that education is probably the frightening thing. And I had a summary then on my question, but I was wondering whether to ask you, how do we educate that missing generation that of parents that we now have that don't know how to cook? But that isn't the question I'm going to ask, because that was too easy. So, in summary, I think that the farms business has a huge role to play in getting fresh fruit and vegetables to the food stores and providing future food security, which is exciting. That's why I love my job. And we're also doing an awful lot to enhance the green credentials for the group by being able to do practical things on the ground. We're doing a lot of research. We're working with probably about 8 university projects that we're involved with, trying to be leading edge in the way that we farm, which is exciting as well. And then that bottom point about we're passionate about educating the children and I think the public, so more and more concerned about the general public. I mean, the children are wonderful to teach, but it's all the parents I'm worried about where their food and also where their energy comes from. And, this whole idea of growing biofuel, biomass crops and putting it into energy. It's just saying you do realise if you do that, that is a crop that is no longer going to be producing food. But the question I decided to ask you, I've been delegated by my chief exec a seat on the Hilary Benn's Fruit and Vegetable Task Force. The question I want to ask is, do you think there should be a target for food security of fruit and vegetables in the UK? And if the answer to that is yes, what figure do you think we should be pushing for? Thank you.
Right, well, good morning, everyone. Just waiting for the slides to catch up with me. That's great. I'm Peter Couchman from the Plunkett Foundation. A little bit more about us later on. What I want to do in the time that I've got is to build a bridge. I'm conscious that in this audience, we've got some people that really put huge energy into transition across the north. And I've also got a whole bunch of people in here who've actually spent their lives working on developing cooperatives. And I want to try to look at how do we actually build this bridge between it. So I'm going to try and talk to both, but probably at different times I'll be talking to different groupings there. To start with, what I want to address is perhaps those who've come from a transition background thinking, I'm still not sure what this linkage with cooperative is. And to get that across, I want to go back in time, and I want to go a long way back in time. I want to go back to the 1820s, where we had Robert Owen throwing in ideas at the time that were seen as radical as transition is seen today, often were seen as offensive by the ruling classes at the time as well. But he actually started to gather around him a whole bunch of people that were saying, maybe there's a different way of thinking about the world. Maybe the route that we're going down isn't the right one. And the one that really made me sit up and think was those people have left us a whole legacy of how they tried to capture that vision. And some of them wrote about it, and some of them set up organisations or communities, etc. But there was one person that actually tried to draw it. And I've never seen this picture in any cult publication. I think for today, it's fantastic. So this guy, unknown, tried to capture what was it in the 1820s those people were putting their energy into. What would the world look like if they succeeded? And this is that picture, villages of cooperation. And what we see here is a world in which you've got individual communities that are actually addressing the needs they saw of the time in terms of social justice. So real empowering employment, education, housing, but also you notice around that growing and other opportunities there. So they had a vision of what was it we actually needed, how collectively do we do it in units in which we still feel empowered. And that was the starting point of their vision, and that's the roots of the movement that exists today. And that went onwards. We then had, well, I would say probably using our phrase now, not a phrase he would have recognised, the first cooperative blogger. This is William King, and each week he would publish, so each month rather, he would publish a very simple newsletter called The Cooperator. And what got him up in the morning is he says, I can buy into that vision, I've got that, that's what I think the future lies, but I completely disagree with many of you for how you're going to get there. Because your language appears to be, I think government's going to come along and do it for us. And he says, if you think that the powers that be have ever in human history passed on the power to ordinary people, well, A, history doesn't show that, and B, I don't think the future will either. The only way it will happen, he said, is step by step of communities doing it for themselves. And the model he promoted is start simple. Simply grow some crops together and trade them between each other. And when you've made some money there, apply that to, for instance, starting a shop. And if that shop also starts to make some money, then maybe buy some land. And if you grow together on that land, maybe buy some housing. So his end point was that those villages' cooperation. But he says the only genuine method was us doing it together. I think we're on common ground with transition so far, yeah? If we go a bit further in history, because this became the huge inspiration for the expansion of cooperatives after that, we then come on to the familiar vision to many people within the cooperative movement of the Rochdale Pioneers, the first modern cooperative. But we've rewritten history. Because the co-op is by and large associated with grocery stores, although obviously many other activities, and Christine did a fantastic job of bringing some of those out, we've rewritten it to talk about them as grocers, because they achieve many fantastic things there. But if you go back into their actual documents of what got them up in the morning, if you go back to where their passions lay were, they have one very simple phrase of why they were starting this. And that is, and I use their words deliberately exactly, we want to create a self-supporting home colony. They were just starting that shop as the first step of that vision. So therefore, what we have is not two completely separate movements. We actually have, as far as I see, wave after wave of different generations saying, how do we identify the fundamental challenges we face today, and how will we as individuals come together collectively to tackle them? This is simply the cycles of history within it, and I think there's fantastic learning and connection to be had there. I'm also slightly cautious about with it. One, every so often you sit through lots of presentations you basically go to agree with. And every so often you come across one that you can't reject, but it leaves you feeling uncomfortable. And I did one of those this year with this guy here, who's Professor Ian McPherson. And his contributions to cooperation are enormous. Basically, he took the traditional values that link all those cooperatives around the world and turned them into a modern document around what our values and principles are. Incredibly powerful to actually think that from that Rochdale Pioneer basis, yeah, we now have got 800 million cooperative members around the world, touching the lives of over 2 billion people, employing 10% more people than every multinational on this planet put together. Fantastic role that he had. But he'd done a new piece of research where he'd actually gone and looked at what had the co-op movements been saying about themselves and seeing as their challenges since 1900 onwards? And he looked at it generation by generation. And he found two things. The first thing was every generation says, this is our moment. This is the moment it's going to come real. And the opportunities now are better than we've ever had before. And secondly, they said, and the time we're in is worse than it's ever been before. Our challenges have always been have never been as big as we've got now. And that really gets me unsettled, because I'm standing here thinking, actually, I do think the things that Rob's outlined and the things that have drawn us together today are worse than we've ever faced before. And Ian sort of plants that seed of doubt of saying, don't think no one has been here before you. And also, I think the opportunities are incredible. But again, he planted that challenge. So I think, it, to me, the one was, therefore we can actually learn from those in the past. Which brings me on to the Plunkett Foundation, which I'm very proud to lead, which is part of that radical tradition. In a nutshell, and a very brief whistle through how we started, we were started by Sir Horace Plunkett. And Horace was born into privilege. He was born into a wealthy Irish family, and educated in a traditional way of Eton and Oxford, etc. But something happened along the way that he started to challenge the world. And he very quickly formed a viewpoint that said, just as we're reacting to climate change and to peak oil, that what he was looking at is, where is the Industrial Revolution going? And his view was, he was seeing it sweeping across Europe. It had dramatically changed the landscape of the urban experience across Europe. And he saw it heading towards rural Ireland. And he said that basically people had two choices. They either waited for the hurricane to hit, or they actually came together to shape the world that they wanted to actually survive from that. And they would actually take any opportunities that were in that change, but also preserve what they thought really mattered within there. So he led the movement that created the Irish cooperative movement, and particularly that was agriculture-based, because that was the economy they were in. So his role in life was literally going from community to community, making them believe that they weren't helpless, they could actually take action, and actually encourage them to think about what action did they want to take. Often that would be cooperative creameries, often that would be community activity within there. But again, the tactics being used are just frighteningly close to the tactics we're using now. Not to say, I have the answer standing up here, but saying, all I can do is encourage you to believe and to take an action that works for you. In terms of farming, what he said was that basically there was three things that we had to get right to get that forward, which we describe as the three betters: better farming, better business, and better living. What he meant by that was that if a community chooses to actually take control of their future and rethink how they farmed within that community, they have the right to be put in their hands the best possible technical options to do so. In other words, they shouldn't have to reinvent wheels. They should be able to see what others have done, see the opportunities that lay there, so their energies were kept within solving their problems rather than simply relying. So he didn't have to relearn every single time. By better business, he was absolutely clear he meant cooperative business, organisations that would actually bind people together and lock in the benefits for it. And by better living, he meant, and it always was one of his serious points, that any business model that over time disconnects from the communities it has come from is ultimately doomed to fail. That community connection wasn't something just at the start, it was something that your business success for the future relied on. And the world would actually be a weaker place whenever those connections were lost. So another way of looking at that is to see what he said is we have to get right is the technical, the economic, and the social. And if you just do two of those, don't bother. It's not going to get there. You actually have to balance all three for it. So what we see in that language is not only a methodology that I think we can see resonance of what we're trying to do there, but sometimes it just gets a bit frightening. To give an example of that for me, or the one that I just literally started to reread and think, have we rewritten this or something? Was Horace was also very close to many people within the States. He'd spent time as a cowboy over there as part of improving his health, a rather strange bit. But he actually knew a lot over there, and he was a very close friend of President Theodore Roosevelt, so he had a huge influence on their policies. And in the late 19th century, he actually wrote a letter to his friends in American government, sending a warning. And he says, what you've done to create modern American society, which they saw as this, you know, obviously tremendous, huge leap from where they'd been, has been fantastic, but you've actually based it on some false assumptions. And one of the key ones there was, what has driven you so far to this, in terms of your access to energy, isn't going to last forever. And so he actually sends a letter warning them, and again, it's the exact phrase used in his letter, the dangers of peak coal. I don't know where he got that from or how. I haven't seen it elsewhere within it. But sending that message, everything you have built on sand, you're approaching a point at which downwards that curve continues. So a slightly frightening one for us there. Some people have been there before us on that. So why do I go through all of that? Because I think that actually is the line between and that bridge between our thinking around transition, our thinking around cooperatives. Because the role of the Plunkett Foundation is applying that thinking to our generations today. Now, by and large, we work with rural communities rather than towns, but what we're seeing is a tremendous unleashing of energy around people wanting to take control within their communities. Just picking a few from these pictures here. The role of farmers' markets, I'll touch on a bit later on, but that idea of actually reconnecting with agriculture. A huge exploding sector for us is community-owned village shops, 220 now. At the height of recession, more starting this year than ever before. Even the Archers are talking about doing one for Ambridge, so we must be making somewhere. We're having fascinating discussions with churches about how do you use church space for community engagement and control. You know, my biggest challenge this year was addressing a church conference. You go up to the platform ready to speak, and then the chair leans forward and says, while you're presenting, it would be helpful if you could mention God. I have to say that I think my example of how the Jamaican communities actually use their churches to encourage enterprise was an example of divine intervention, so I think I met there. Obviously, and it was touched on in Rob's, and I'm hugely behind, is rethinking about renewable energy towards community control and generation there. Delighted we've got energy for all here today. And our role is actually just getting communities thinking around that, thinking about how they can also grow, thinking around issues such as the pub, which is a huge one for there. And the one that I always throw in is tucked away at the bottom, you can just see that down my Rob there, of my favourite example, Llanreth in Cornwall. This is a wonderful one there. Someone pointed out that this month we actually have Social Enterprise Day on the 19th of November, and with brilliant planning, it's also World Toilet Day. I'm sure that many of you, keep that clear in your calendar to celebrate within that. But someone said, well, yeah, there's no connection between the two. Well, this one is. This is a community enterprise where the only option they had left to them was to take the village toilet and turn it into a community store that not only is a highly profitable service to them, but also brilliant at selling local food as well. So the world's first, but I'm sure not only, toilet-based enterprise, and the facilities are still available there as well. There's no stopping it when people get going. So yeah, we're part of this whole, it's amazing, my favourite one is if someone said to me it's the best example of convenience retailing they've ever seen. But there's this whole energy being unlocked out there. We have the privilege of trying to take some of that forward. A big part of we do that through is through the Making Local Food Work programme, which is referred to many times, I'm pleased to say, in Rob's book around local food. And this brings together a whole range of different organisations, not just ourselves, but the Soil Association, Sustain, Cooperatives UK, Country Markets, CPRE and Farmer. And we're really trying to do two things on here. First of all, we're looking at the individual building blocks of how do you actually tackle local food issues. So things such as community-supported agriculture that the Soil Association's leading on. What are going to be the best models for that for the future? Looking at things like food co-ops and buying groups. You know, local food should not just be a rural and market town issue. Every person within this country should have a right to access there. And these people are working in some of the most difficult, some of the most deprived communities to actually be raising those same issues that we've got the privilege of talking about here. Farmers' markets, what are the next stage there? How do we ensure genuine connection for the farmers in this new world that's opening up? How do we actually give models that let them turn towards the communities that they've grown up within rather than away from? Home-produced food. Country markets are one of the best-kept secrets. 60,000 people making food in their own homes and then trading it with others. Real opportunities for what they can do there. And our own work around village shops for how to encourage those to constantly refresh that connection with their own community in terms of selling local food through their activities there. And also tackling some of the really knotty problems about distribution and supply. Again, communities where economic impacts are even harder. How do we make sure that that isn't a barrier to them being able to connect with local food systems? Issues such as governance, and Mark's running one, who's in the picture here, running one of the workshops later on. How do we ensure that we actually enshrine the very best within there and make sure that we deliver? And more, a little bit more on that later. What's the forms of enterprise support that are needed? What's the knowledge that should be being transferred in there? Again, another strand of the work. And last but by no means least on that one, food webs, work of CPRE, of starting to map out, a bit like we saw for Top Ness, of what's the knowledge in there. So a whole range of wonderful opportunities. And if we do just that, that's good. But where I'm coming from is it's got to be more than the sum of its parts. That basically, each of those in itself is great. And the energy in there I just find inspiring. But it's how do we actually start to connect them up? How do we actually have a vision where what we want to end up with is not individual initiative, but a local food system, one that actually brings the whole lot together? And this, to me, is the bridge between transition and cooperation. It's vital that each of those enterprises can actually stand on its own two feet, deliver a real need, and actually be self-generating in the long run, being able to renew that vision and to keep going, so it's a solid base there. But also they need to be within a framework that lets them interact together. And that, to me, is where that bridge starts to come in. To me, each of those individual initiatives, ensuring that they're enterprises means that they're solid, but we've got the wonderful mortar binding between them of the community engaging and flowing it all together. And that would be my urging to anyone involved in transition, is thinking of enterprises securing the long term. Because that's what cooperative models are. They are, by and large, resilient models. They keep going generation after generation. They keep adapting as the next generation takes control and redefines what its particular needs are. So they actually keep the vision, and that vision is still there, but they actually then enable people to actually pass on that to go forwards. The way that I put it to finish is it's rather like saying it'd be a great thing to plant a tree in a pot, and you get the pleasure of the tree, and you've actually done something for you. But when you actually choose to plant it in the ground, you make a whole series of other statements. You actually create something. You're saying, this matters in the long run. That what I'm doing today, I actually want to carry further on. You actually start with not just simply your own personal pleasures with it, but the belief that someday is actually going to be something more than that. You actually believe that what you've done today is going to be worth carrying on for generation after generation. And that, to me, is the bridge between the two. That cooperative models, which around the world inspire people to do things almost undreamt of within there, give a model that transitioners could actually use to ensure that that vision keeps going. So that, to me, is the bridge that's worthwhile. But I'd like to finish with the question, which is, I know a number of the audience, and I know sort of the passion that they engage with these agendas on. I don't know you all, but I'm sure that passion is there as well. My question is, what is it in your life that you're engaged with that matters so much to you that you would like to think that generation after generation is going to benefit from that as well? And you want to make sure that part of your life's work is actually keeping that going. So what matters so much, you want to make sure this isn't an initiative that goes with you, but carries on for the future. And I think sharing that would unlock an awful lot for us. So I hope that's helped to build a bridge. I look forward to exploring it with you. Thank you very much.